Hello and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble in Dalgety Bay, and I'd like to welcome to the show this evening Anna Beck of the University of Strathclyde. And over the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to be talking about Anna's PhD, which is around the development and implementation of Teaching Scotland's Future, the report and agenda over the last few years in Scottish education. Welcome to Edutalk, Anna.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
And just to start off with, as always, could you just introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Of course. I'm a lecturer from the University of Strathclyde. I work in the School of Education, lecturing in teacher professional learning, but also teaching around policy processes and things like that. I've been there for 2 years, and recently finished my PhD at the University of Glasgow.
That's great, thanks. And so what was the kind of background to your PhD, and indeed the kind of context within Scottish education around the time that you embarked upon it?
Okay, yeah, so the overall aim of the PhD was to trace the implementation of Teaching Scotland's Future. So really that could have been taken in lots of different ways. But as I kind of got into it, and started speaking to people that were involved in the implementation, I realised that I wanted to focus on the National Partnership Group, which was this group of people set up to think about how to implement the recommendations. So just to give a bit of background to the actual policy, Teaching Scotland's Future, that was published in 2011, and it contained 50 recommendations for the improvement of teacher education in its entirety. So it was actually quite radical in nature in terms of some of the things that it was setting out to change, quite wide scale. And the Scottish Government accepted all 50 recommendations, either in full, in part, or in principle. So this was seen to be quite a kind of significant shift away from, in previous policy developments where maybe the government would take parts that suited their particular agenda. So this was seen as quite a big thing. They then set up this group, the National Partnership Group, that became the focus of my PhD. And this group had representation from lots of different organisations in Scottish education. And they were in operation for a number of months. And their aim was really to think about, like, how do we put these recommendations into practice? So that was the focus of my PhD. Who was in this group? Who decided who was in this group, how were people chosen, and how the group actually operated as well, so whose voice was heard within this process.
And at this point, and I know you've been on Edutalk before, of course, Anna, but you could you just remind us of some of the kind of highlights of the Teaching Scotland's Future report in terms of the 50 recommendations, and then go on to kind of firm up what was your specific research question, and then maybe talk about your methods and your methodology.
Yeah, of course. So in terms of kind of key headlines from the report, the key things that were coming out were around teacher professionalism. So in the report, there was lots of mentions around the need to reconceptualise teacher professionalism in Scotland and to reimagine teacher professionalism. But there was a lack of substance as to actually what that meant and what that might look like in practice. The other key theme that was coming out was the need to focus on partnership between local authorities and higher education, and actually between lots of different, all the kind of key stakeholders in Scottish education in terms of teacher education. The report also really focused on the intellectual nature of teaching, stating that teacher education should remain within higher education, which, you know, is quite different to what we've seen in England, for example, with the introduction of Teach First and Schools Direct. Another key recommendation was that teachers should study at master's level within teacher education, really focusing on that kind of intellectual nature and be involved in research, practitioner inquiry, things like that. Moving on to the research questions, which I think was the next thing that you asked me to do, but stop me if I'm wrong.
No, on you go, Anna. Yep.
Okay. So looking at back at this kind of partnership group that was set up to think about, right, how do we take this agenda of partnership and enhancing teacher professionalism and putting it into action? Looking at this group and really thinking, right, who was excluded from the partnership group? So we know who was included, but who's not there within that group? And what are the spaces where policy translation is happening? And the second question was looking at how do people actually represent an organisation within this space? So say, for example, there was four or five people asked to represent the General Teaching Council for Scotland, but how do they actually represent the interests of that organisation within such a big group? And then the third question was looking at how institutional actors, so how organisations like the General Teaching Council, like Education Scotland, for example, how they would then translate their interests into the policy agenda. Because we know that as policy moves from a set of recommendations through to implementation, there's something that happens in between that stage where policy changes. And there's lots of studies that look at the content of policy and then look at the implementation of policy at a school level. But there's not very much that looks at what happens when it goes through this kind of process of consultation within a partnership group. So how does it change and who's changing it and why? So that was really the kind of key focus there.
Now, years and years of work, and myself and others have followed it with great interest, Anna. Can you boil down your findings for the benefit of the EduTalk listeners?
I can try to. So in terms of what I found, I have some so what points in terms of these are the big things. But in terms of looking at those research questions, I have some kind of key things that were found out in relation to these. So I might just work through the research questions one by one. That's probably the easiest way to do it. And then finish with the, like, how can we use this? The main points. So in terms of the first research question, while also looking at who was involved in the network, within the partnership group, I also wanted to look at the different spaces where policy implementation was happening. So where people were able to kind of change the agenda, and have a say and use their voice to actually say how this should be implemented. And I found a number of formal and informal spaces, which probably won't come as a surprise to people that have been involved in things like this before. There's the big formal meetings, there's the formal process of consultation, there's focus groups, there's consultation events in different places in schools and universities. But then there's lots of informal spaces, such as conversations between individuals on the train journey back from the formal meeting, conversations over the phone, smaller things like this, and it tended to be that this was where the real policy was made. So I should say that all of this is based on 30 semi-structured interviews with members of this partnership group. And quite often the people in the know would tell me that the real policy was made not within this larger network, but actually just between two or three key actors. And it tended to be the case that within the informal spaces, it was members of the traditional policy community that would have a say. So, people that tend to be asked to be involved in policy making in different areas. So, for example, Curriculum for Excellence, the McCormack Review, it always tends to be the same people and the same organisations that are invited. And then some extra people are added in. But it did tend to be these people from the traditional policy community. And Walter Humes writes a lot about that idea. There was a lack of transparency within the process as a whole. And the construction of the final report, this seemed to be the most important space in terms of, at this space, it was the most amount of opportunities for people to actually input their voice into the agenda. But this, again, was just done between two or three people and ended up being quite highly governed by the civil service. But again, maybe this is just something that is bound to happen within a policy process. But if that's the case, then maybe we should be more transparent about that process in terms of letting people know to what extent they can influence the agenda, but that there's an endpoint to that. In terms of the membership criteria, this seemed to be driven by the need to have an equal number of representation from each organisation. So this did create a sort of partnership model, but quite often people would talk about members from the group would say, oh, we should have had so-and-so there because they really do have knowledge in this area, but they couldn't have been included because then there would have been too many people from the universities. So there seemed to be a need to have a kind of balanced representation to the detriment of the group. And as well as this, some individuals didn't know why they were selected to be part of the group. They didn't really know why they were there, which has implications for the extent to which they can really participate. But the majority of the people within the National Partnership Group did come from this policy community. So, you know, they tend to know each other on a personal basis. It's the same faces around the same table. And that's not always a bad thing. It sometimes means that things can happen quicker if people know each other already. But then it does make it very difficult for new people and new voices to enter into that space and really have a say. In terms of who was excluded, the obvious one was the teacher unions. They were not formally represented within this partnership group, which seemed very strange because, you know, you had the General Teaching Council, Education Scotland, universities, you had local authorities, and you had individual teachers. So then not to have teacher unions was seen as quite a strange move by the Scottish Government. But there was a slight compromise solution to that, in that one of the teachers actually had a significant place within a teacher union. And I never quite got to the bottom of why they were excluded. There were so many different reasons as to why. Also, the final thing I want to say about that is that there was also the inclusion of individual teachers, and that they weren't brought in until halfway through the process. So I think there were two or three teachers from the very beginning, and then more were added halfway through when there was a realisation that there wasn't enough teacher representation within this network. But of course, some teachers then felt that this was slightly tokenistic, in that they'd been added halfway through and didn't really know how the network was working. In terms of the second research question, and I'll be faster with this one, the main conclusion I came to there was that representation is a very, very complex process, and it's far more complex than I think the people creating this situation realised, in terms of institutional actors are fragmented, they're multiple. So, for example, ADES, the Association of Directors of Education in Scotland, you know, they represent 32 different local authorities. And each of them have different priorities, have different economic situations, have different agendas. And to have two or three people representing that big group was fairly difficult. In terms of who should represent teachers as well, this came out as a really big theme in the interviews, with lots of people saying, well, maybe the teacher union shouldn't represent teachers because they speak for a particular agenda, whereas other people said that individual teachers cannot possibly represent the teaching profession because how can they know what teachers are thinking? Teacher unions are there to democratically represent the teaching profession. So that was a really big thing that came out. And then another thing which was quite surprising was that the General Teaching Council for Scotland, obviously an extremely powerful organisation within teacher education, although they were represented within the group, they weren't given as much power as other organisations. So, for example, the National Partnership Group itself had three co-chairs, and then there were three subgroups, and each of them had a chair. Now, each of these positions were taken by different people representing different organisations, but not one of them was given to the GTCS. And I have my own theory as to why that was. And the final question, in terms of looking at actually how these different actors managed to influence the policy agenda, the first thing that I looked at was the culture of the network. And I discovered that there was what some people refer to as the culture of consensus. So there does seem to be this kind of general belief that in Scottish education, lots of the different organisations and lots of people involved in education have the same view, the same vision and the same hopes and aims for education. And that is true to an extent, but different organisations do have different interests and different agendas. But what this creates is almost a simulacra of order. So, you know, we have a situation where we believe that in Scottish education we all think the same and we all have the same values, the same beliefs. So therefore, in a public situation, representatives of organisations can't be seen to disagree. So what you get is a very polite situation. And so many of the interview participants told me, I just wanted to say what I really thought, but I couldn't because everybody was being so polite. Really had to get the meat on the table and discuss things so that we could move forward and create change. But there just wasn't the space to do that. And I wonder to what extent, to really create change, we need to get those differences out on the table and talk about them rather than being polite and being careful about stepping on other people's toes. And the result of this was that the representatives of the institutional actors, the representatives of GTCS, Education Scotland, ADES, they behaved in three ways. So they were conservative and resistant to change. So basically silencing the agenda and saying, yep, it's a great idea, but I'm not really sure how it can happen. Or they protected their institutional interests because they've developed a sense of ownership over particular areas of teacher education. So there was a lot of kind of positioning and stating claim to particular things in teacher education. And there was also the subtle subversion of remit points. So each of the subgroups of the National Partnership Group had set remit points for how to for things that they had to think about in terms of how to implement. These were set by the civil service. Now, a few interview participants complained about some of the members trying to subvert these remit points. And bearing in mind the remit points were created from the recommendations. So you would think in a process where a partnership group has been established to think about how to shape the recommendations in order to implement them, that there would be some sort of subversion, that there would be some sort of change. But this wasn't allowed to happen, which shows you the kind of prominent role that the civil service played and the way that some actors maybe supported this kind of governing role. And my final point here is about the involvement of individual teachers. Now, the overall aim of the Donaldson Report was to support teachers to develop agency and autonomy, to see themselves as agents of change and be involved in creating educational change. So you would think that this means being involved in the creation of policy, having a voice in the creation of policy. But actually, the process that was set up to enact this vision, if you like, actually sat at a tension with the vision itself, in that the teachers in this process, the majority that I spoke to, said that they didn't feel like they could influence anything. They didn't feel like they could speak at these meetings because they didn't really know the rules of the network. They didn't really know how it operated. Some of them didn't know why they were there. This wasn't explained to them. And because they were brought in halfway through, they didn't really know the way that the process was working, and this didn't seem to be explained to them. And at various points, they said that things would come from nowhere and there'd be a document with their name on it that would say that they'd contributed to it, but actually they hadn't. So this left them feeling quite disempowered, and I think has implications for the way that we kind of include teachers in the creation of policy making in the future. Overall, I think some teachers felt that it was very tokenistic. and felt more disempowered than they would have done if they weren't included in the first place.
Thank you so much, Anna, for sharing your findings. And you know, I just wonder what, you know, what's been the implications of your findings. I'm wondering in the years since Donaldson. I mean, we're talking, you know, 6-7 years now. You know, have things changed? Have, in your opinion, things changed for the better? I mean, I know we had the governance review recently, and I think that was done over a much shorter time scale. So, you know, I'd be interested in your thoughts as to whether people have taken on board your research, or whether it's too soon, or whether if people have realised that the process needed to change for the kind of next major policy.
Of course, I think there's two things there in terms of the general shift in policy discourse and the different kind of agendas that we're seeing at the moment, and but also the processes by which they're made. And I've obviously not looked at the creation of the governance review in depth, but this is an area that I'd hope to research next. But it does feel like it's a lot faster. You know, the National Partnership Group, that took about 2 years for them to have all these meetings and discuss what to do. And at the end, their main recommendation was to create another partnership group to continue to think about how to implement the recommendations. You know, that was a very long and drawn out process. And it might have worked well, it might not have worked well. It's difficult to say. But what we're seeing now is very, very fast, although there does seem to be a lot more opportunities for people to get involved. There's all these kind of national consultation events. There's consultation online. And there does seem to be a slight more awareness around it than perhaps there was around Teaching Scotland's future. And it might just be because the implications for the governance review are a bit clearer for schools. So there does seem to be more opportunities, but it does seem to be slightly quite tightly controlled in terms of the time that's allowed. So, for example, one of the online consultation documents was only open for quite a short time period, and it was around Christmas. So maybe it wasn't Christmas, but it was around a holiday time. And I think, you know, that has implications to the extent to which people can really participate within it. In terms of the agendas changing, what Donaldson, I think, was trying to do was to kind of create some flexibility for teachers, to promote teacher autonomy and teacher agency, to support teachers to take responsibility for their own professional learning, to start to lead professional learning for other teachers, and to support the kind of teacher-led professional learning, grassroots professional learning that we're seeing through Pedagoo, through TeachMeet, things like this. But the policy discourse now is very much around measurement of teacher judgment, measurement of pupil attainment, and it feels to me to be slightly more tightly controlled, and that kind of flexibility is being taken away.
And I just wondered, did that relate to your recent talk on where did Donaldson go, as in where did Teaching Scotland's future go?
Yeah, exactly. So this is a talk I did a few weeks ago, asking where did Donaldson go? Not the man himself, but the agenda. And I think it's very difficult to see the kind of the key aims that were originally in his original report within any of the policy documents that are coming out now, apart from stuff around the GTCS and what they're doing with the revision of standards. I think it's still in there to an extent, but within the kind of national government priorities, the national improvement framework and the governance review, it's quite hard to find.
And so what about for yourself then, Anna, in terms of your own research and work, you know, what's next for you?
Well, I'd like to continue to research the policy process, and really look at the processes of consultation and how individuals are selected to sit with on various groups, and the way in which different people can influence the agenda. I think that's a really important thing, because quite often we get bogged down looking at the content of a policy document, but actually that's not what's going to be implemented in practice. You know, you see a lot of kind of bold statements, but actually what happens is quite different, and that's because of the different people involved at the various kind of stages in between. So this is what I want to look at now in current policies. So applying this model that I used in the theoretical framework from looking at Donaldson to now look at more recent policies.
And you know, it's been fascinating listening to you talk about your PhD this evening, Anna. I wonder, you know, whether you can say a bit about what kind of response you've had either within academia or kind of policy circles, government, etc. And also maybe a bit of advice for researchers out there about how you might have done things better or how you might have changed your approach if you were to do it again.
Of course, I've got lots of advice about how to do it differently. I think when you're ever doing such a big project over a number of years, it changes a lot as you're doing it. So originally what I set out to look for in terms of my research questions changed throughout those 4 years. And I think that puts a lot of researchers off in terms of it makes them feel quite nervous, but actually it's okay. And your research has to be flexible and adaptable to the current situation. And that also goes for your theoretical framework. And I know that this is quite a controversial point because some people might disagree, but I think I really saw theory as a toolbox. You know, so I was taking constructs and concepts that I found useful for that particular data at that particular time, rather than feeling restricted by having to stick to one very particular type of theoretical approach. And that really worked for me, and I think it really worked for the data in terms of it allowed me to look at everything that was coming out from it. In terms of the response from other people, I haven't had any response from the policy community yet. I'd be interested to hear what they think. In terms of fellow academics, I think what I find probably isn't a surprise. We knew that this is happening, and to an extent, in a way, it can't be helped. But I think it helps to kind of show how it happens, and reveal the kind of more subtle ways that organisations can really start to influence the agenda. And I think we do need to look at how we include teachers and those affected by policy a lot more. And rather than kind of doing it in a tokenistic way, I think we need to do it in a far more transparent way.
Well, I hope the movers and shakers are listening to the podcast this evening and engage with your doctoral work, Anna, and I'm sure they'd be well advised to take on board your recommendations. It sounds like it kind of offers people with a kind of pathway to make the necessary improvements in the future. I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on the show this evening, and I wonder if you could just leave us with maybe ways that we can find out more about your work or indeed get in touch with you directly.
Of course. If anybody's interested in anything that I found or the different approaches that I've used, or just wants to get in touch with any comments, maybe you completely disagree with me, I've had that before, then you can tweet me. It's Anna_D_Beck, or you can email me at Strathclyde, and my email address is anna.beck@strath.ac.uk.